Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, and welcome back to Bookends with me, Marianne Stone, and my mentor and guru, Morin Rout.
Oh, gosh, no, that gives me... I've got terrible images coming into my head when you say that. So, no, your colleague. Your co-presenter, producer.
Well, Morin, what have we got on this week?
We're looking at children's books, basically. And it's probably a good time to be doing that because, you know, in the next few months or whenever, the Children's Book Awards will come out and there'll be a lot of talk. And there's been some marvellous books, new books put out, as always. I'm going to be talking to Claire Mabey about her sequel. The book is called The Raven's Eye Rebellion. It's the sequel to The Raven's Eye Runaways. And Claire just about scooped the pool for awards for the earlier book. So there will be a huge number of fans waiting for this sequel.
Really, I'm waiting. And so, yes, that's right. It's a season of sequels, but I am not talking to authors with sequels. I'm talking to authors for children's books. Both have got lovely kind of environmental consciousness and science themes. Maria Arto, Lost in the Wild, and Mary Duff, A Discovery in the Rocks, beautiful children's stories. And I really enjoyed talking with both authors. This morning, I am chatting with Maria Arto, who has produced a delightful children's book called Lost in the Wild. Now, Lost in the Wild is based on a true story, and we'll hear a little bit about that. It's Lost in the Wild, A Dog's Tale. Maria, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Kia ora, Marianne. Thank you for having me.
So, Maria, tell me the personal inspiration for this tale about these two foxies, I think they look like, aren't they, on the cover. Tell me about these two foxies.
Yeah, they were foxy crosses. They weren't purebreds, but they were family dogs, and we'd moved to the country, and one of them came to visit from her other house where she was staying with Kevin, one of the people in the book, and she took the little one Borry off for a walk, and we that was it. It was a worrying time, but it did have a happy ending in the end. So
I think with children's books, it doesn't matter if we do spoilers,
I'm glad you said that.
I think, I don't think it matters. This is a beautiful book about two little dogs who get lost together in the wild, and one stays lost for a long time until there's a reunion at the end. It's heartwarming. The illustrations are lovely. Talk to me about working with an illustrator to produce this book, Maria.
Well, I was very lucky to have C. Ferguson. She's become a friend, and she is sort of just on the same wavelength as me. She does beautiful animal, she's an artist, so she actually can, she looks at something and can just visualise how it's supposed to be looking. The cover was just, I was just blown away by it. It was just really jumps out at you, and she's captured those two little naughty beasts very well.
Well, but so much love and warmth in their eyes, isn't there? And the Aotearoa Ngahere, the bush, is really beautifully rendered as well. The family and the relationships and the animals are all extremely cool. Of course, we don't just get loving animals in this book.
We've got all the baddies of Aotearoa Bush. Do you want to talk to us about what their role is in this book?
Well, I call them the baddies, but I am an animal lover. All creatures, great and small. So I really call them baddies because in Aotearoa, we've got the, you know, the threats to the native species, the animals and the bush. And, yes, there was – I wanted to demonstrate by the way of the using a true story but putting a fair bit of creative license in there to show exactly what everything's all about and explain about the, you know, biodiversity crisis we have in this country and the threat to native species. So that was my whole sort of angle, and I thought, what better way to discuss that than using our own personal story?
Yeah, and the dogs' encounters in the wild with goats, possums, pigs, and in particular, and then at the end we've got one more predator encountered, not in the wild, but at the cafe. and they're such. Personalised images, you know, like they have so much personality, these images. And even though the creatures are predatory, there's still something fond in the depiction, as you say. We can't blame the animals, even though they're problematic. Mm. Yeah.
And they aren't illustrated to be super scary anything like that, but they actually are there, and the dogs get frightened by them and run off to their next encounter.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's quite, we could only imagine what they did out there. And, you know, luckily, Kiwi were introduced in the bush, into our area. It's quite a large area in 2023, so there wasn't any Kiwi there then, so I would have been mortified otherwise.
Oh my goodness, of course.
Because it was probably
lost dogs.
Dogs are the worst.
Yeah, lost dogs themselves are part of the problem, aren't they? So that is a nice note to know that these dogs pose no threat to any of our ground dwelling birds on their scary adventure.
If anything, they probably would have flushed out a possum. They were pretty good at doing that. And because, you know, Borry was very hungry when we found him a week later, but he obviously lived on something.
Lived on something, exactly. That's right. These dogs are renowned for going rabbiting as well, aren't they? So, and getting stuck in tunnels. So these two had actually a lucky escape and a happy ending. The book has a bit of a feel of the Three Billy Goats Gruff or something like that, you know, the encounter with the animals and then the moving on to the next one. It's got a lovely fairy tale kind of effect, the animals with each other. But
And we can imagine the thunder and lightning. That was actually a creative license as well, but that would have been something that would have forced them to go separate ways. And one found a week later, the other one found a year later. So, discovered by chance.
Discovered by chance. It's a beautiful story, and it's called Lost in the Wild, A Dog's Tale. Thanks so much for joining us this morning on the show to talk about it, Maria. Can you just tell us also about the program that it promotes? So at the end, there's education here about the program Predator Free 2050. Tell us what that's all about.
That's an initiative to get people out there doing their bit for, you know, trapping and control, predator control. I personally do quite a lot here on our property. Here she is, the animal lover, but I think I'm a firm believer in humane eradication methods, because we just cannot have the level of destruction that has sort of got out of hand for many, many years. And there's so many amazing people out there that are volunteer trappers, and I just think if everyone can do their small bit, and, you know, with the greater council and government input as well. We have on our property probably every couple of years, I think it is, the council comes through with, they have their contractors that do possum control. And I have noticed a huge difference. There's not been many possums at all. You don't even see them on the road, squashed. So when we start seeing them coming back again, that's when we know these guys will come out again and do their possum control. And it's made a huge difference to the, particularly the bird life in this area. We've been getting all sorts of kaka and the tuis have been amazing. And, yeah, everything's just sort of thriving at the moment. The kiwi are doing well.
The kiwi are doing well. That's such a good story. We didn't hear, you know, several of our stories that we cover have some element, especially children's stories these days, have some element of conservation message. The predator control one's really very important, and this book does it beautifully. Of course, the goats and the pigs are sometimes a bit of, even a harder problem to stop, aren't they, than the possums?
Yes.
Much bigger effort involved across the board for deer, goats, pigs, possums, all the predators that we need to eradicate to have our ngāhere and birds thrive. Yeah. So thank you very much for your contribution to that message. It's been a pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you very much, Marianne. And, it's been a pleasure.
You can get a copy of Lost in the Wild, A Dog's Tale from booksellers nationwide. Goat Island Publishing.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM. Streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
The discovery of a rare and ancient Tokorahia whalebone in Duntroon, South Canterbury, has been captured in a children's book by Mary Duff. The beautiful science and storybook is illustrated by artist Burns Pollock, and also pictures by the pupils from Duntroon Primary and by Mary herself, who was a student there once upon a time, not so very long ago. Duff joins me in the studio to talk about this beautiful project and the story behind it. Tēnā koe, Mary.
Tēnā koe, Marianne.
It's really lovely to have you on the show. So this is a personal story on lots of levels, isn't it? Do you want to just tell our listeners all about that, about how the story came to you?
Sure. So I guess everything changed after I had children. I realised, how are they going to understand about, you know, the world, and especially this unique place I grew up in? It's just got those outcrops of ancient Oligocene limestone right there at the doorstep of...
Which kind of limestone?
It's called Oligocene.
Oligocene.
Oligocene, yeah.
Okay, Oligocene.
So it's 23 to 30 million years old, approximately. It's a seafloor. And I didn't realise how important it was until I kind of, you know, went overseas and had more perspective in life. And then, you know, when the children came, especially my nephews who now live on the same farm that I grew up on, I was like, I'll just write this little story for them to... So they understand these slippery rocks that are, you know, you can't grow grass on them. Cattle can't graze on them. They're always in the way. The farm is, you know, clustered around these outcrops. I just want to help them understand the taonga that's underneath their feet.
Mm. And it is the most amazing landscape, isn't it, as you're driving through it. They're everywhere, really, for a while, aren't they?
Mm.
Yeah. So, and you grew up there.
I did, yeah.
Tell us about that. Tell us a little bit about your childhood.
So it was pretty idyllic, really. I was one of four children. I was the eldest, and we lived about 50 kilometres from the nearest town. So that's a 45-minute high school bus ride into the local high school. So it's a long time to think and look out the window. I know I explored the rocks a lot, especially when we had visitors. We were always taking visitors around the rocks, show them the different caves that we had named and collecting fossils. I remember when I was halfway through writing the book, I suddenly had this memory of collecting these tiny star-shaped fossils.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, I just can't believe I've forgotten that, and I'll have to write it into the story somehow. Mm. But, yeah, they're the cross-sections of the sea tulip ancestor, essentially.
Wow.
Yeah.
My dog's obsessed with sea tulips.
Really?
He finds them and wants to eat them all the time. Yeah. So, you know, weird. But anyway, so I know, I can imagine what the cross-section looks like. So, Mary, hang on, I've just got to get my pages right here. I love the intentions in this book, right? You can really feel them on every page. There's this engaging our tamariki with Aotearoa, with our prehistory, with science generally, but also with nature generally. And all of that is communicated in the book beautifully, but it's also was part of the project of making the book, wasn't it? And so I really would love you to talk about that agenda, why it's important to you, and also just tell us about the project of making the book.
Yeah, so when I first talked about, you know, writing this little DIY version for my nephew, I never thought that would be see the light of outside the family. I didn't think that I would ever publish a book or, you know, become an author. But I had a job that involved talking to bookstores, and the local museum had a bookstore and they were wanting more stock. So I mentioned this story and how, you know, it was just... So they were like, well, you know, that Professor Ewan...
So you mentioned at the local museum,
yes,
that you had drafted a story for your nephews about the Duntroon Rocks.
That's correct, yeah.
Right, okay.
And they were like, oh, well, do you know that Ewan Fordyce, the professor that's in the story, is not well and he's retiring? And I was like, oh, no, that explains why he hasn't answered my questions, because I emailed him because I just couldn't nut out how it all worked with this, you know, the rock formation and things. And I thought, oh, gosh, I've got to hurry up. I've got to, you know, get these answers if I'm to finish the story. And they said, well, yeah, it'd be amazing if you could, you know, put the story as include it in a tribute that we're going to publish for him.
Mm.
And so I quickly, you know, finished the text. And then as I was working through it, I thought, oh, this is a little bit more than just something. It needs more polishing. And I can see more in this than just being a little, I guess, a little story without images in a tribute publication. Mm. So I continued forth. And it's just this project that snowballed. Mm. And, yeah.
And so involving the school and Burns Field, how did that all, Burns Brooks? No.
Pollock.
Burns Pollock. So involving the school and Burns Pollock, how did that all evolve?
Again, it felt like a snowball. Once I kind of just started, because I should re-explain, a connection with Duntroon School was quite strong. I would read these drafts every probably 6 or 12 months to test it out every time I was down visiting family there. And it just, you know, got better and better. And I was talking about illustrations and I was talking to, you know, other students I went to school with and saying, hey, you know, I've got this project. Do you want to, you know, they were artists and in their own right. And I said, do you want to illustrate my book? And they're like, oh, I'd love to. I'm at uni this year, maybe next year, or I'm busy with another project. And then, of course, I was looking for grant funding for publishing. Mm. And I became aware of a local community grant through the local council where children's art can be funded through the grant. And I thought, that's it. And Burns Pollock, I forget the exact order of things, but it just all fell together because Burns is retired from producing art now. He's in a care home, but he's very lively and loves visitors. And I visit him as often as I can and we talk about everything in the world. But he just wasn't able, even at that point, to produce new material. But right, he had existing art that I could take elements from and then combine it with all of the creatures that the children produced.
Fabulous, fabulous. How beautiful. And so it's very local to the area. And I think the community feel like they've really embraced it as a project of theirs. Is that, would you say so? Like with the book is selling well at the local museum and there's, what's it called? The, untouched world or
what? Vanished.
Vanished, the vanished world. So that because there's a whole museum dedicated to this phenomenon, that this is a kind of a pit of seabed that's risen up.
Yes, in a nutshell.
Yeah, in a nutshell.
In a nutshell.
For the non-scientists among us.
It's also so significant that it's been endorsed as a UNESCO Global Geopark.
Right.
So that was when was it? I've written it in the book, I should know. But it is globally significant. We have visitors from around the world coming to see these sites, as well as there's a total of 15 sites within the North Otago region that are destination.
And do you hope to inspire kids to be, archaeologists, scientists? Is that kind of part of your ambition for the book?
Duntroon in North Otago is quite remote from big cities. It's roughly halfway between Christchurch and Dunedin. And children in these areas don't get a lot of exposure to public art and authors and poets and archaeologists. I mean, we do have occasional geology students coming up from Otago University, but they don't really have a connection with the primary school, for example. Mm. So it's good that children can take whatever they want from it.
Especially me
coming from that school and them seeing me, occasionally and having that connection.
Yeah, and it was a lovely engagement of ours with the Hagley Writers Institute. So where I'm studying and you're studying as well, you're intending to do more writing, having a science background yourself, really, haven't you? And kind of not having thought that you'd be a writer, you intend now to do more writing?
I do. I want to share knowledge has been along the way. In fact, it fitted well with my career before because part of my role was teaching and training others about how to, do this particular process in a factory.
Mm.
But now I did some more study and I did some public health study as well to be more of an educator role in the community. And the two together, I'm like, well, I guess science communicator is a good title name that fits what I'm doing, and I do have other stories in my mind that I want to share.
Lovely.
And I thought, yeah, I'll go to Hagley and then I can learn how to write a book.
Yeah. Well, you've got lots of the beautiful elements here of children's story, and it is a children and a science book, and I really encourage parents who are listening to think about finding themselves a copy, and just to give themselves a taste of that, I'd love you to read us a sample if you would.
Sure.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you. This is a few pages in. Sophie explores the rocks after CUDA and at the weekends. What is this? Wonders Sophie. Could it be a giant's ear? Sophie rushes home. Mum! Come see what I have found. She takes her mum to see the strange object. Her mum agrees. It's very unusual indeed. She sends a photo to paleontologist Professor Ewan Fordyce. He'll know what it is. Ewan brings some of his students to see the unusual object. Sophie leads the way. Ewan and the team scratch, scrape and brush the rock away from the fossil. What is this? Asked Sophie. Could it be a dinosaur's leg? Professor Ewan scratches his beard. Not quite. This is long jawbone from a large marine mammal. It's got pointy teeth at the front, but none at the back, he observes. It must be a grandmother monster, decides Sophie. Ewan smiles. It's more likely to be a whale fossil, he says. A very special one that I haven't seen before. A whale? What was a whale doing out here, so far from the sea? Wonders Sophie out loud. Well, a long, long time ago, this land was mostly under the sea, explains Ewan.
Beautiful, beautiful. And so then we have the whole story from there and the creatures illustrated by the students of Duntroon. It's and the history of the professor who discovered it, and some of Mary's soul written into this beautiful book, A Discovery in the Rocks. It's written by Mary Duff. You can find it at Mary Duff online, so maryduff.com, Or you can go to the Vanished World, the Vanished World, and visit for yourself and get a copy there.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Claire Mabey's first children's book, The Raven's Eye Runaways, had a phenomenal response, being awarded the Best First Book Award at the New Zealand Book Awards for Children and Young Adults. It was shortlisted for the Esther Glenn Award for Junior Fiction, and it won the New Zealand Book Lovers Award for Best Junior Fiction. This sequel is called The Raven's Eye Rebellion, and it continues the story, which is set in a magical medieval world. It's a world where reading and knowledge is strictly controlled, and this time, having run away, our brave protagonists realise they need to start a rebellion and gain control. You say, Claire, that it hasn't got easier to publish a sequel, I guess, but was that so in actually writing the sequel? Because I'm guessing the world was there for you.
It was easier and harder at the same time. I actually wrote a different version of the second book and it wasn't working. And I realised that what had happened in my mind was the world had become so big that I was a little lost in the world, like it just kept growing, and so the kind of boundaries just kept expanding, and what I needed to do was return to the characters and just let them tell the story. And once I did that, it came much more easily. I realized that the first book really was setting up the problem, and the second book had to be more triumphant and not easy by any means, but a kind of more triumphant story that focused on the relationships as much as the problem. And that was fun. I enjoyed that.
Once you got that out of the way.
Yeah.
And I guess, yes, that's what I was thinking. The runaways run away because they discover, you know, how the world is working against them and against most of the people in that world. But yes, they then need to start the rebellion, don't they?
It's interesting. I was really inspired by child logic. Like I just often, and this comes from talking with my son and his friends and other children that I meet through the book world. But I just am always stunned by how logically children see the world, and they just know quite innately what's wrong and what's right, much more free from the complications of systems that adults, you know, have to kind of participate in. So I wanted these kids to have that optimism and power and force of conviction, even though that it's not particularly easy for them either. They kind of come up against it a lot in this book, but it was really fun for me to live through them, to kind of remember what that's like, to have that optimism of actually I can change stuff. I can kind of push up against it, and even if we don't completely change the world, we've made a difference. And I think that's good for adults to remember as much as it is for children. Children know it. I think children know it in a way. But it's really cathartic to write that.
Yeah, I was remembering, you know, having my children at the age that this book, the age group that you've written the book for, because it seems before they get into the kind of complexities of being adolescents, it is clear for them in that sort of 8 to 12 years. They can get incredibly passionate about climate change and natural justice and people being bullied and so on and so forth. So books like these are so important to them because empowers them, it entertains them, but it also gives them that optimism that it can be done.
And I think in a fantasy book like this, you can let the children do the things that they're not allowed to do, you know, like run away and not really have adults around them and do all these things that I think at that age, I just remember craving adventure and craving that sense of independence. And you can do that in books. And that is also what's cathartic about it, is you can break up the boundaries and kind of really shake up what's possible.
This is set in a medieval world, and that's a world that you're very attracted to. You know a lot about it. And so researching things like this must be a joy to you, Claire.
It's so much fun. It's interesting. I am very interested in that world, and I think it's because, you know, that whole thing of the past is another country, but also the past is our present. It's just not that far away. And I think as soon as you start to look at the way systems operated in the past, you can kind of start to see all sorts of mirrors reflected in the present. And that, I think, is really interesting for fantasy in particular, because you're at the same time you're overlaying made up things over, you know, a framework from the past. And that's this really weird collision of, you know, my present time, our world, and this time's gone by. And I don't know, there's something just so strange about that. And this book is about strangeness.
Yes.
And it just fit. It fitted the world, like dragging that kind of technology-free, quite oppressive battle of ideas. You know, I was very influenced by King James the Sixth and his Bible and his publication of Demonology, and how those books, those ideas battled each other, and also how, you know, he spurred on this scapegoating of women with his witch stories. And I just find that endlessly interesting and perpetually true. Like, we still do that. There's still books out there that kind of put forward these really harmful ideas that, you know, more often than not turn women into problems. And I really wanted to play with that.
This is sort of almost a non sequitur, but I was interested that, you know, talking about witches and Getwin, your heroine, I love using that word because it's, you know, it's a questy kind of term. But, you know, in the first book, there's the raven, and the raven's eye is, she's able to see through the raven's eye. In witchcraft, the raven, would be thought of as a familiar.
Totally.
But in this book, suddenly he is a familiar, but a familiar of a different type, isn't he?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that character, the Raven Sharp, and I knew what would happen in the first book, and I actually worried a little bit about how kids in particular would feel about what happens to him in the second book, because he transforms, not to give it away too much, but he transforms completely and becomes a very different relate, you know, the relationship changes. But it was really hard to do, I have to say. It was probably one of the hardest things to do. And the changing back and forth was both fun, but also almost a way to do it gently.
Yes.
I didn't want to land.
You didn't want,
with this kind of burdensome, in a way, person.
Yes.
Too quickly. And his character, the characters, funnily enough, for me, are the easiest part of writing. Everything else I find brutally hard, but characters tend to come to me quite whole, except for that character. I really had to work him out and understand what his temperament was, what his relationship would be, what he would want his relationship would be, and how everyone else would feel about him. And that was really interesting and really hard.
It's always intriguing to me as a non-writer to realise how much writers grapple with characters and characters sort of resist them rather than, you know, being easily moulded into what the writer wants them to be. And Dory, in the way that you tell it, is again, a process of you negotiating with the story, isn't it?
Yeah, I think all stories are negotiations and all stories are, it doesn't matter what it is, but everything comes with, everyone brings something to it, no matter how simple or familiar the story is. It's different for everybody. And I think, yeah, that is a huge part of this world and this book and writing. And every character is a story of their own, and that character changed the most for me in the drafting. Like, I had definitely had him wrong, and I knew he was wrong because the other characters just, I couldn't get their reactions weren't coming. So I realised I just pitched him in the wrong, I don't know, sometimes I think of them all as quite musically, and he was just hitting bum notes all the time. And so I just had to kind of it's the weirdest process in the world. Like, I can't even really explain it, but I just had to keep going through almost my own psychology to try and figure out on a deep level who he was. And that leads itself to backstories and all sorts of things that aren't in the book and that readers won't know. So writers, I think, sometimes carry around all of this extra information, and you have to slow it off and get down to the bones. That's hard.
And must be hard, sort of, because you're putting so much emotional and physical and, I don't know, psychological, whatever, time into this, to have to cut yourself off to do all the other things that you do. You're the book's editor of the spin-off. I love reading what you write. I always click on it the moment I see it. You organise festivals, and then you've got this rich and totally intricate thing going on in your brain at the same time.
Yes. When you put it like that, it sounds a bit crazy, and it is a bit crazy. What I do, the way I manage it, is I have one whole day a week, so Fridays, where I write, and I'm very strict about it. I don't work on anything else, and I don't look at my emails. I have a device that stops all apps on my phone, so I just don't get distracted. And once I'm in, I can write all day without stopping, and that's, I'm so glad I can do that, because I just can't write in snatches. I just can't. It takes me a while to get in, and then it takes me quite a while to get out. Yeah, I'm just very strict with how I use my week, basically. It's the only way for me.
Yeah, it must be. It must be. And it must be hard to pull yourself out. You've said how much joy you've got once the first book was published, in meeting children, going out, talking to them about your book, but talking to, hearing back from them what their reactions are. This time it's going to be even better in a way, because you're going to be meeting up with so many who have read the first book and are, you know, gasping for the second.
I mean, I'm quite scared. I suppose the thing now I've realised is I want them to love the second book and not be disappointed in the direction of it. But meeting children is such a delight, and I find it very energising, it gives me a lot of optimism. I just meet so many readers, and you hear lots about decline in reading for pleasure and kind of worrying trends along those lines. But when you're a children's author and you get to go and meet so many children, it's the opposite. You just feel like you're meeting children who are constantly searching for stories and want stories and want to talk about them. And I just find them just insanely creative and logical and funny and energetic. It's nothing like a kind of, when you're feeling tired and middle-aged, there's nothing like a kind of 10-year-old bunch of kids to perk you up. Like, they're just so fun. And I feel my 12-year-old self come alive. It's sometimes, it's almost a bit weird. Like, I feel like I'm talking to peers. And I think it's because my brain is trying to find that when I'm writing. And so when you're talking about that world, when I'm talking about that world to my intended audience, I don't know, it's delightful. Like, the inner child is still there.
Well, I don't for a minute imagine they're going to be disappointed by this new book, Claire. And I gather we've got, you know, more books to look forward to, not necessarily a sequel. I think you feel like, but there could be, who knows?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like, I have got a third book in my brain. It's a jump forward in time, though. So it's in the world, but the world will be a little different when we see it again. But, yeah, before that, I'm actually writing two very short novels, which is really great challenge for me, set in Wellington. So very different. Still for kids and still fantasy, but, a more of a real-world setting.
Well, there are fantastical things happening in Wellington. We know that.
All the time.
Yes. Lovely talking to you, Claire, and good luck with this new book. It's called The Raven's Eye Rebellion. It's by Claire Mabey, of course, and it's published by Allen and Unwin. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rath, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Next Tuesday on Plains Media.